I am not good with tough decisions, Michael. I'm struggling.
Can I help?
Not unless you can anticipate all of my needs and tell me the exact size and color of the Burberry Rocking Horse bag I should get.
Okay, what are the options?
Okay, well, the Rocking Horse bag is one of the new iconic styles masterminded by Burberry's chief creative officer, Daniel Lee. And in addition to the signature Burberry check, it also comes in 6 spectacular shades.
Right. The British really have a knack for naming colors. It comes in ribbon, daffodil, and vine, a verdant green.
I also find these leather goods almost impossible to resist. Handcrafted outside of Florence at Burberry's Manifattura, which is a highly specialized workshop, the pieces are exceptionally high quality. I think I'm going to go for the ribbon color and the medium size. It's really the perfect shoulder bag.
I'm going to check out all the options at Burberry.com and get back to you with a few more suggestions.
Love it. Happy Saturday. It's April 27th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
It's been a very heady week in the news, Michael. On the campuses of Columbia, Yale, and NYU, the pro-Palestinian protesters have staged demonstrations across these college campuses. Administrators are struggling to defuse the tensions. Meanwhile, in the UK, Rishi Sunak had a political victory at last after passing the Conservative Party's immigration policy that will send asylum seekers on one-way flights to Rwanda. It is not a popular move. Human rights lawyers have described it as inhumane, and legal scholars are wringing their hands over its implications. Meanwhile, in New York, Donald Trump, also on trial, charged with 34 felony counts related to the hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels. Last week, he was falling asleep in the courtroom. Now he's signing off on social media to the extent that Justice Merchant, the judge assigned to the case, is threatening to put him into contempt of court. Michael, we are here not to talk about any of those things. Instead, Aramel, as always, is the antidote to all of that.
You're exactly right, and we've got a wonderful show today. First, Howard Bloom, who has been following the story of Brian Koberger, the man accused of killing 4 students at the University of Idaho, will tell us about a pair of revelations that just might upend the government's case against him. Then, here on the East Coast, Ashley, you know warm weather has arrived, and that means one thing, as far as I'm concerned, the season of bad behavior by wealthy people and more than a few strivers on the east end of Long Island has arrived, and Carrie Monahan has the details on how one of New York's most notorious private clubs is trying to open a spot out there, and why many residents are fighting it. And finally, speaking of bad behavior, many of you know the film Mommy Dearest, which stars Faye Dunaway as Hollywood legend Joan Crawford. Well, there's a terrific new book out about the making of this movie, which reveals how a project that began with such big ambitions has found itself an unintentional camp classic. And the author of that book, A. Ashley Hoff, will join us to dish the dirt. So, Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Well, Michael, let's start with Howard Bloom. He's here to make sense of the November 22 murders of 4 University of Idaho students. It has captivated the nation and certainly captivated all of us at Aramel. Howard is the author of several books, including the Edgar Award-winning American Lightning, Terror, Mystery, and the Birth of Hollywood. And his latest is When the Night Comes Falling, A Requiem for the Idaho Student Murders, which is going to be published in June by HarperCollins. Welcome, Howard.
Good morning. Nice to speak with you again.
Before we get too much into the details of the case, for those who aren't familiar with it, what exactly happened in Idaho, and who is Brian Koberger, and who are the victims?
In November of 2022, on November 13, 4 students, Kaylee Gonsalves, Maddie Mogan, Ethan Chapin, and Zanuck Kernodle, were found dead in an off-student campus house of the University of Idaho. No one knew why they were killed, and there was no suspect. 6 weeks later, across the country in Pennsylvania, a graduate student in criminology, Brian Koberger, was arrested. He's been in jail, accused of the crimes, for the past year and a half. During this period, both the defense and the prosecution have been moving very ploddingly forward, exchanging motions and counter motions, asking for more discovery documents, each one fighting the other. But there's been no prospect of a trial. The case is sort of dragged on. The trial might not happen for at least another year, probably longer. And in these events, what I talk about this week is a hearing that occurred on the beginning of April, and it revealed almost inadvertently, almost as if the lead was buried, as a reporter would say, in the course of the cross-examination, some fascinating things about where the case now stands.
So, Howard, you mentioned there was this hearing, some developments happened there that, by all indications, you think is going to really rock the prosecution's case and the ability to sort of convict here.
Yes, the hearing began as a rather banal sort of hearing, another plotting judicial maneuver. The defense ultimate goal is to move the trial out of Moscow. They think that Koberger, the suspect, the criminal justice student, cannot get a fair hearing in this town. Everyone knows about the case. Everyone has an opinion. So they commissioned a telephone survey to call up potential jurors and ask them some questions. And this surveyor, who's worked on many cases in the past, began calling 400 people. And he asked them a series of 9 questions. 7 of the questions were pretty simple stuff. Do you know that a suspect has been arrested in Pennsylvania? Do you know that a knife sheath was found on the bed of one of the victims? And a large majority of the people knew that. The prosecution didn't even want him to ask these questions. They said he, by telling them facts, he was nevertheless tainting the jury pool. But what really got people enraged was that he asked 2 questions. These 2 questions were, have you read that the suspect, Brian Koberger, was stalking people, the victims, on social media, and that he was stalking their home on King Road where the murders occurred? Now, this has all been reported in the media and press. For the first time, both the prosecution and the defense admitted that this is not true. There's no evidence that Koberger was stalking the victims by driving by their house or following them on social media. Why is this significant? Well, if he wasn't stalking them, then the whole reason of why these killings occurred, this narrative that the prosecution is trying to put together, is knocked asunder. And if there's no motive, the case becomes shakier. I mean, look at what the prosecution has. They have no motive. They have no murder weapon. They can't identify that Koberger was behind the wheel of the car that was seen in the area on the early morning of the killings. And they have some DNA evidence, but this DNA evidence is touch DNA rather than blood DNA. And this is impugned in the courts in recent cases. So it's really pretty shaky stuff.
We have a lot of maybes in this sitting here now. As you also reveal in your reporting this week, there's another maybe which happened behind a closed door hearing between the attorneys and the judge. What did you learn about that?
Well, this is the most perplexing aspect of the case up to date. In the course of the court hearing on April 10th, both the prosecution and the defense are discussing what discovery information will be made available. The defense begins by saying that they don't want all their discovery information to be revealed because it could, quote, endanger individuals. That means that what they know could put someone or someone's life in danger. This sounds like they're hiding a witness. And that suspicion is further reinforced when the prosecution speaks, and this is what they say on the record, that yes, the discovery information could endanger, quote, a confidential source. A confidential source. That means that if this trial ever takes place, both sides are saying that there is some individual or individuals who could turn this whole case inside out. One can expect that if this trial takes place, and it's not scheduled for at least a year, and it'll probably be longer, that there is a sort of, as if in a Greek drama, a deus ex machina, which will come down into the proceedings and provide a unexpected conclusion or a bit of information that will change the course of events. This is tantalizingly held back from the public. It's being only discussed behind closed doors, but it was something that came up in passing in the court of this most recent court hearing. At this point, Koberger has just the flimsiest of alibis. His alibi on the record is that he was out stargazing. That's why his car might have been spotted, or if there's telephone was pinging off cell towers in the area, because he likes to drive around late at night.
Howard, what do we know definitively, if anything, about how Koberger may have identified these victims or initially connected with them?
At this point, you ask a very important question, and there is no definitive answer. And there was a great deal of rumors, and it also appeared in print in many publications, not airmail, I will say, that he was following these people on social media, and that never happened. What the prosecution has done up till now is tried to put him by the house. They say he drove by the house 14 times. Well, when they say he drove by the house, that means The cell phone was picked up in the area. Cell phone trajectories cover 13 miles. That's pretty big in any area. But in a town like Moscow, you can be visiting many places, not necessarily the murder house. It's as if saying your cell phone is in Greenwich Village and you're going to the airmail offices. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to one specific place. And if for the first time, the prosecution is now admitting to some degree that their cell phone data might not hold up in court, and there is no proof that he was stalking these victims or really driving by their house. But now he's not at the scene of the crime. He's at the neighborhood of the crime. And that's a whole lot of difference.
Howard, just to go back to where this was revealed in this pretrial hearing, you have a sort of, I guess, interesting suggestion that was based because his defense wanted to maybe try and move this trial out of Moscow, a small town, maybe get people who might not know about it. But you're arguing, in fact, the best chance to sort of get off is probably to stay in this small town. Why do you believe that?
I think this is a mistake. Because consider the jury pool in Moscow. The defense has just been doing a quantitative analysis, looking at different numbers and percentages. They're not taking into account that many of the people in Moscow, many of the people who will be in the jury pool in this small town, belong to the Christ Church group. This is a church group run by Pastor Doug Wilson. And it's been a controversial group. But Wilson is a very charismatic figure. He's talks in a very reasoned and reasonable way. And in my conversation with him in his office, I sat with him in his book-lined office, and he said, well, I recommend any of my parishioners who are picked for a jury to be very skeptical of anything the police say. Why, I asked? He said, because we know the police have lied in courtrooms before. And what he's referring to is many of his members protested against pandemic restrictions in the town. They had a prayer in. Some people were arrested. His son and his grandson were arrested in various charges relating to that demonstration. And Wilson is enraged, and his congregants are following his lead. They are, in effect, at war with the town legal authorities. And I think they would look at anything the Moscow police say on the stand about Kohberger with some dismay.
Howard, as I was reading your reporting, I was thinking about what torture this must be for the families of the victims. What are we hearing from them?
That's the sort of second tragedy. First, you lose your child, and then you see the events drag on and on and on. I wrote in a previous piece, I think part six, how one of the fathers has sort of become a detective. He wants to get to the bottom of things himself. But the families are also raising their voices for not just the death penalty, but also that the Idaho just passed a law that if you can't find the chemicals necessary to make the lethal injection, and that has happened many times, the death penalties get delayed and delayed and delayed. They're calling for a firing squad, and this law was passed primarily aimed at Kohberger, and it went into effect last June. And now if Kohberger is found guilty, if they can't find the chemicals, he will have to face a firing squad. And these families have become, at least one of them, have become obsessed with this. In many ways, what we have here is a community of both victims and the victimized, and they're all going to exist in this anguished, tortured state until there's a sense of justice, and yet justice keeps on getting delayed and delayed and delayed. It's another tragedy.
Well, Howard, thank you so much for your reporting and for sharing this with us today. Fascinating stuff. And we can read more about it, not only in this week's issue of Airmail, but in your new book, which is called
When the Night Comes Falling, A Requiem for the Idaho Student Murders.
Howard, thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Speaking of small towns with big dramas, on the other side of the country, over in the east end of Long Island, Ashley, there's a little town you know called East Hampton.
Oh, yes, indeed. Rich people are getting upset about traces of the big city impeding on its small town community feel. And Carrie Monahan is here to explain what happens when Zero Bond tries to bring its oons ways into one of the most expensive and bucolic places in New York. Carrie Monahan is a Brooklyn-based journalist and a part-time East Hampton resident here to make sense of it all. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
It wasn't all that long ago that the Hamptons were a bucolic, beautiful oceanfront community full of rolling lawns, tranquility, big houses, of course. Now we're here to have a conversation about nightclubs in the middle of East Hampton. What has been going on?
Yeah, so The village of East Hampton has a number of historic inns, including the Hedges Inn, which has been running, I'm pretty sure, continuously for 150 years. And last week, rumors began to circulate, namely in a very active Facebook group called the East Hampton Civic Coalition, that the members-only club in Manhattan and Las Vegas, Zero Bond, where Mayor Eric Adams is a member, as well as, I believe, Elon Musk and Taylor Swift, was negotiating a lease with the historic Hedges Inn on Main Street in the village of East Hampton.
Now, Carrie, we should say that the village of East Hampton loves a good old-fashioned rule. I mean, this is a place where no fast food restaurants are allowed. I believe there's a law against neon signs. The village used to be known for its charming little hardware shop. Ina Garten's Barefoot Contessa was there at one point. And now all of a sudden, Main Street is full of Prada boutiques and everything has changed. So what are the laws that are in place to protect that quaint feeling that East Hampton built its reputation on?
So East Hampton Village, which is within the town of East Hampton, East Hampton Town includes places like Wainscott, Amagansett, Montauk, etc. And the village is much smaller. East Hampton Village has very stringent codes in place to basically keep East Hampton quaint. So those include zoning ordinances. Those include very strict sound and noise ordinances. And it's very hard, despite the arrival of places like the luxury brands that you mentioned, Gucci, Balenciaga, Prada, etc. It's very hard for any business to even change the way its storefront looks. So this kind of tension, especially between, I guess, kind of old money, I guess you could say, longtime generational residents and sort of loud luxury of kind of newer money clientele, that's been an ongoing tension for the past couple decades.
Let's get down to brass tacks. Loud luxury is really what this is. This is the really rich people against richer people. Right? Who's leading this fight against Zero Bond, which has a sketchy reputation here in New York, right? And who's leading the fight and what's going to happen here in your reporting?
Yeah, I guess in some ways, the battle over Zero Bond, if you want to call it that, I mean, it's all pretty premature. They're only still negotiating a lease, can be described kind of as a fight between the haves and the haves. But at the same time, local businesses like the Hedges Inn employ a lot of local people, local kids, servers and bartenders. And when these kind of bigger city-based hospitality brands come in, they often bring in their own people. But in terms of who's kind of leading the charge against Zero Bond, it's actually the mayor of East Hampton, Jerry Larson. And he is putting forth, or he has put forth, legislation that would restrict the hours of operation for all of the inns, all five historic inns within East Hampton's historic district. And honestly, it sort of was surprising to me as a part-time village resident that it was this mayor and this particular village administration leading this charge, because as I sort of get to in my piece, this is a mayor who was elected in 2020 and his whole platform was about being pro-business. East Hampton, as we have discussed, has a lot of red tape when it comes to really changing or doing anything. And this mayor seemed pretty keen on what he described as revitalizing downtown. A number of his donors were billionaires, though they could only give $1,000 each, including Ron Perlman, who is the mayor's longtime client. The mayor runs a private security business and has done so for something like 20 years, including when he was chief of the village police. So suffice it to say, when I heard about this legislation and heard that the mayor was backing it, I think like many village residents, I was sort of surprised by who it was coming from, because it doesn't necessarily jive with the rest of this village administration's policies, many of which have kind of rankled the long time residents I've discussed.
So Carrie, what are the stakes here? I mean, if Zero Bond were able to open in the village of East Hampton, like, are we talking about loud music reverberating? I mean, this is a community that like gets up in arms over paddle tennis being too loud.
Right. Yeah. An anecdote. I don't know if you all ever look at the East Hampton Star's best police blotter calls.
Carrie, I don't even live in East Hampton anymore, but I still live for that column in the paper. I still subscribe just for that.
Yeah. So, for example, a woman in the village of East Hampton last summer called the police to make a noise complaint, and it turned out the sound she was hearing was just the ocean. So people love to make noise complaints in East Hampton. People love to complain generally. There isn't a particularly high level of crime. So this is sort of what the police, the village police at least, are called upon to deal with often. I think that the question of Zero Bond's presence, and it still is a question, nothing has been finalized, is will it be a late night club as it is in the city, which is something that neighbors are very fearful of, or will it be, as one lawyer for the Hedges Inn described it, a sort of low-key supper club that will be closed by 10 p.m. and will not be a true nightclub? So that's a question that remains to be seen.
Well, it's got everything I love, which is rich people behaving badly out in their summer houses. I kind of hope Zero Bond gets their thing, because then there's just more to report on.
Yeah.
Carrie, as I was reading your story, I was thinking, is there fear that East Hampton could possibly become the new Montauk? I mean, because a lot of these debates and conversations have been happening in the hamlet of Montauk because so many New York City nightclubs have kind of opened up there. And it has, in many ways, changed the nature of Montauk. Some would say for better, some would say for worse.
Montauk definitely is a cautionary tale, but the motivation behind this new legislation, which again would limit businesses in the historic district from serving food between certain hours, so between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., they can't serve any food, which brings up complications with room service and other things. But the motivation, at least according to the mayor in a conversation I had with him about this new legislation, is not just unique to fears over the Zero Bond issue with the Hedges Inn. Over the past couple of years, a bunch of larger hospitality brands have taken over management or ownership of some of the local inns. So the Maidstone Hotel, for example, which is a 150-year-old inn not far from the Hedges, that is now owned by the same hospitality group that runs Scarpetta. And Scarpetta, as you might know, has an outpost at Gurney's on Montauk. And it's certainly a space beloved by influencers, Bravo celebrities, etc. And then there's also the Hunting Inn, which is where the Palm, the steakhouse is, which has been bought a couple of years ago by a Texas billionaire who owns a bunch of the Golden Nugget hotels and casinos, as well as a national steakhouse chain. And the Hunting Inn is in this battle with its neighbors that's been going on for a couple of years now over its plans to build a swimming pool. So there are a lot of new developments in terms of the inns being taken over by brands that certain longtime residents see as objectionable or see their intentions as potentially detrimental to the so-called character of the village of East Hampton.
Carrie, it's a great piece of reporting this week.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
I am not good with tough decisions, Michael. I'm struggling.
Can I help?
Not unless you can anticipate all of my needs and tell me the exact size and color of the Burberry Rocking Horse bag I should get.
Okay, what are the options?
Okay, well, the Rocking Horse bag is one of the new iconic styles masterminded by Burberry's chief creative officer, Daniel Lee. And in addition to the signature Burberry check, it also comes in six spectacular shades.
Right. The British really have a knack for naming colors. It comes in ribbon, daffodil, and vine, a verdant green.
I also find these leather goods almost impossible to resist. Handcrafted outside of Florence at Burberry's Manifattura, which is a highly specialized workshop, the pieces are exceptionally high quality. I think I'm going to go for the ribbon color and the medium size. It's really the perfect shoulder bag.
I'm going to check out all the options at Burberry.com and get back to you with a few more suggestions.
Love it. Michael, honestly, not missing East Hampton right now. Missing New York and you, but not East Hampton.
That's not summer. That's not relaxing. But you know who I feel would be hanging out in Zero Bond or in one of those clubs out in the East End?
Tell me.
A woman named Joan Crawford.
Bless her. Oh my gosh, we've got to talk about this. Mommy Dearest, one of our favorite films, at least one of mine.
Well, as it is many people's. And we have A. Ashley Hoff to talk about it. He's written a new book in which he details how this movie became an inadvertent camp classic. So let's bring him on. Welcome, Ashley.
Hello, hello.
So, Mommy dearest, let's just start with the big picture. Your book is riveting, fascinating, dishy. It's good this is coming out now in spring because it's going to be a great summer read. So how did Mommy Dearest, a movie that was greenlit with aspirations of greatness, become a camp classic?
That is a very good question, because it is a movie that had... Mommy Dearest was released in 1981 for Paramount Pictures. It had an A-list star, Faye Dunaway. It had an A-list director, Frank Perry. It had studio backing. It had an A-list budget. It had top flight set and costume design. I mean, it's a beautiful, lavish film as far as the aesthetics go. It had everything going for it. It was based on a best-selling memoir written by Christina Crawford. And unfortunately, there were a lot of things that happened on set. Basically, the film ended up coming to about 3 hours or so in the rough cut. And of course, that was unacceptable for a major feature film at that time. So they had to cut entire scenes or sequences or all the interim stuff. So what you were left with were these very jarring scenes, the most obvious being the haircutting scene, the wire hangers and bathroom cleaning scenes, chopping down the rose garden scene. And you have these really heightened moments with absolutely no buffer between them. So one minute you have Faye as Joan winning an Oscar and how triumphant that was. The next minute she's going off on little Christina. And it was a very jarring result.
I think that's exactly right. It's all these sort of boom, 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 high drama moments, or they veer into high camp moments. And as we said, like high expectations. This is based on her daughter Christina's memoir. She was reportedly paid $250,000 to write it. They supposedly wanted everyone from Joan Didion to Tom Stoppard took a pass at this script. And Bancroft, who was the first choice, Franco Zeffirelli is going to direct it. So how does Faye Dunaway come into this then? I mean, how does that happen?
Well, essentially, Anne Bancroft was initially going to play Joan Crawford in the original conception of what this movie was going to be. And for various reasons that I describe in the book, she ended up dropping out. Simultaneously, Faye Dunaway had heard about the production, and because she was a very big Crawford fan and she very much wanted to, I think on some level, protect Joan's memory, wanted to throw her hat in the ring and did. And the Franks, aka producer Frank Yablans and director Frank Perry, they were ready to roll the cameras and they were caught without a star last minute. Faye Dunaway was interested and made it very clear she was very interested. They took one look at her and took one look at the obvious and said, you know what, let's go with Faye. Hired her. Now we see the result. Frank Perry, who had started as a director in theater and later became a very accomplished director in independent movies, was nominated for his movie David and Lisa, which was the first film nominated by the Academy for Best Picture that was not put out by a major studio at that time. He was very accomplished, but he apparently had a very heightened idea of what this film should be. He wanted a very theatrical story, and he directed Faye Dunaway to give a very operatic performance. Today, we look at it and we would say, oh, it's almost like watching a telenovela. But in his mind, and what he was going for aesthetically, was something operatic. He wanted this to be Medea on the big screen. And so whenever Faye Dunaway has been accused of overacting and chewing the scenery, which she does, and she does beautifully, it's because she was directed that way.
I mean, Faye Dunaway, she's coming off a decade before this. Bonnie and Clyde, Chinatown, Network, 3 Days of the Condor. I mean, she was one of the titans of the 70s Hollywood. Some people think that this film ended her career, really, ended her chance at big roles anymore. Where do you stand on that?
Well, Mommy Dearest has been blamed for it. And then later on, she did a couple of other films that had a similar campy tone. She was the villainess in Supergirl a few years later. But she did a number of quote-unquote over-the-top films because she really, even though she was very talented and accomplished as a dramatic actress, she had wanted actually to move into comedy. And she wanted to be seen maybe with a little bit more of a lighter tone, having more of a lighter reputation. But unfortunately, that did not quite work out. It just did not ring true for her persona. She was always seen throughout her career as a dramatic actress, and she was a method trained actress, so she took everything very seriously. Did this derail her career? When Mommy Dearest started, she had just turned 40, which is, as I point out in the book, a very precarious age for any actress. The times were changing, and the types of movies that were being produced throughout the 80s were also changing. There were still dramas being made, but they were not quite the character-driven drama that Faye Dunaway had always headlined. She really was the poster child for the American new wave of cinema, starting with Bonnie and Clyde and arguably reaching its apotheosis with Chinatown and then with Network. And that era of filmmaking really kind of ended around the time Mommy Dearest was released, because we saw, as the 80s progressed, really the rise of the Spielbergian special effects laden blockbuster movies. And there was really no place, apparently, as Supergirl illustrated, for Faye Dunaway in that particular new realm of filmmaking.
The film, it's become a camp classic, which means it's a guilty pleasure. And I'm curious, you, someone who's obviously done a lot of studying in this film, what are your guiltiest of guilty pleasure moments in this movie for you?
I don't want to just simply make fun of the whole endeavor in this book. But at the same time, let's face it, it is a camp classic. It has a campy reputation for very specific reasons. And I talk about that in the book. There is this particular moment early on in the film where Greg Bowser's character, played by Steve Forrest, brings baby Christina to Faye as Joan, her new daughter. She carries the child. She's obviously enraptured with the idea of motherhood. And she carries the child slowly ascending the staircase, this beautiful streamlined modern staircase in this lovely Art Deco palace in which she lives, and the camera is following her. And then she turns, holding the child toward the camera, and she's framed against the windows, creating this Madonna and child effect. And it looks absolutely ridiculous, because who does that in life? And the truth of the matter is, the concept is that Joan Crawford would have done that in life, because Joan Crawford, being an actress both on stage and off, that's what that scene was supposed to represent. However, to the audiences who do not have that explained to them, you're watching the movie, and if you see it on the big screen, it's just majestic. It's gorgeous to look at, but it looks silly. And you cannot help but just burst out into laughter, because that's the way it reads to an audience member. I think that shot, which I refer to in the book as the Madonna of the staircase shot, but played on camera by Faye or by anybody else who had taken on the role, it just looks ridiculous. So I talk about moments like that, even though I also talk about more serious issues of what both Christina's memoir, as well as the subsequent film adaptation, brought up. So I try to be kind. I don't want to make fun of anybody. But at the same time, here we are. Why does the film have a campy reputation? Exhibit A.
Exhibit A, right. Well, it's a riveting book. If you love movies, if you love Hollywood, if you love inside stories on how films are made and how they go awry, I can't recommend a better book. It's called With Love, Mommy Dearest, The Making of an Unintentional Camp Classic by A. Ashley Hoff. Ashley, it's been fantastic talking with you today. I thank you so much for joining us.
I thank you. You have a great day.
You too. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay, Michael, it is the weekend. I know you've got something you can possibly recommend to us.
I do. You're over there in London. Have you seen A Gentleman in Moscow?
I haven't. Tell me.
I'm sure many of you know the book by Amor Towles, and this is the adaptation of that beloved book of the same name. And if you don't know, it tells the story of a 1920s Russian aristocrat after the Russian Revolution, and he's confined by the Bolsheviks to his hotel. Ewan McGregor plays the aristocrat Count Rostov, and he's just great in this role. I mean, I've always tried to picture him after reading the book, but he brings this great same amount of swagger, and he's just a sparkling performance, a real delight to watch. And it's also, for all the times I sort of imagine the book, it's beautifully shot in this style that sometimes make you feel like you're just inside this little snow globe of Moscow back then. So I highly recommend it. It's called A Gentleman in Moscow, and it is on Paramount+. And you, my dear, what can you recommend?
Okay, Michael. Well, I've been watching Palm Royale, which is this new, I guess it's a comedy-ish on Apple TV. It stars Kristen Wiig as a arrivist into Palm Beach High Society. She's trying to become a socialite, and she's trying to, most importantly, secure her place at the most stylish and exclusive country club in Palm Beach, which is called Palm Royale. But it's a really fun cast with Kristen Wiig and Allison Janney. Laura Dern, of course. I'm only 3 episodes in, but look, just from a visual perspective alone, it's really fun to watch. I feel like Palm Beach is weirdly having a moment. We used to be Miami, was the epicenter of Florida, at least from the world of style, etc. But for some reason, now everyone's talking about Palm Beach.
But it's Kristen Wiig. She's always charming and fun and funny. So I love her performance most of all.
Yeah, like, look, the worst thing that can happen is you lose 30 minutes of your life that you'll never get back, and you'll end up buying a Lily Pulitzer dress. It happens. All right. Well, we wish you all a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Special thanks to our sponsor, Burberry. We love you. Michael, will you please read us out?
Absolutely. And no wire hangers. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputies are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randa Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. But you can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. But in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thank you again for joining us.